everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Media Voices podcast. What, do we think this is the 90th episode?
It is, yeah.
I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Peter, who did you talk to this week?
This week, thanks to Snowmageddon, Chris getting stuck on a train in Belgium, I got the rare opportunity to talk to someone who not only leads a media operation, but who also manages expert analysis of the media and marketing sectors. I was speaking with Brian Morrissey, editor-in-chief at DigiDay, who has been reporting and commenting on this crazy business for almost 20 years.
But as ever, we begin with the news roundup. And very sad news, the pool has entered administration after crisis talks to save it failed. So there had been sort of hints about this for a couple of weeks with some freelancers saying that they hadn't been paid. But the site that was founded by Sam Baker and broadcaster Lauren Laverne, well known if you're in England, was rumoured to be in trouble early last week. So Esther, what was the backstory to this?
It seems to have, I mean, there's been rumours floating around on Twitter for a couple of months now that, you know, freelancers haven't been paid since September last year. And, you know, the editors were saying, look, we're dealing with it. It's just transfer problems with a moving financial provider. You know, we'll get there. And then it was just sort of suddenly last week it transpired that they're in crisis talks. And then, yeah, a couple of days later, that's it. They're gone. I think for people that read the site regularly, it does seem to sort of come out of nowhere a little bit.
Yeah, the outpouring of grief was kind of very sudden and intense. Mm. Felt like a bereavement to some people.
I mean, before we even begin to speculate why this hasn't worked, I do think there's a real sadness around this, because I think people felt like not only were they doing different things, like the way they scheduled their content release and some of the subject matter that they covered, but also the way they did it. They did it with such unbelievable passion, I think. And I think they hired really good people to write for them. And it just seems like, you know, last week it was like, oh, those 2,000 jobs, blah, blah, blah. A lot of those were at Verizon and you know, that's corporate shenanigans. This felt much more personal.
And you know, I've sort of seen these cuts and layoffs coming over the last couple of years as we've been doing this. And this is, I think it's probably the first time this has actually really hit something that I actually really care about. I get their morning emails. It's one of the very, very few things I do actually get in my personal inbox. And, you know, the three stories they selected, they were always sort of intelligent. They were always, they gave me a new perspective on the world, like one that I hadn't necessarily considered before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm genuinely thinking, like, actually, I really don't know how I'm going to replace that every morning.
Yeah, people seem to really think that, people said that this was a place that published stuff that nowhere else was publishing.
The other thing that speaks volumes is, so there was a GoFundMe set up, I think very early yesterday, to help the pool staff and freelancers get paid, because they're basically not getting paid for January. Mm. And that's raised £20,000 already in just one day. And if you look at the comments of it, people are just like, oh, we wish we'd had the opportunity to kind of pay for the site earlier. Like, you know, we wanted to contribute something. Well, here's our way of now contributing.
But one of the things that I just talked to Brian Morrissey about in this week's interview was cash flow, revenue, profit. And if they didn't have the money coming in that they needed to sustain the freelance budget, I guess, was supposed to be quite high because they were paying people well. Mm. If they didn't have the money coming in to sustain that, then it was never going to work.
This is something I've actually written a piece about this week. I think that they had the audience that could have made Reader Revenue work. And they did sort of dabble a little bit, you know, they had their editor's circle, but it was never really well publicised. It was never really an opportunity, if you didn't know about the editor's circle, to actually contribute financially. But they had such a committed audience that I think actually that should have probably worked for a site like this.
It strikes me that the commercial side of this then wasn't being thought hard enough about. I don't know, they lost 1.8 million last financial year. That's a lot of money
for
a business that's got 28 people or whatever.
Yeah, for a relatively small operation, yeah. But there's got to be some very positive things we can take away from the pool, from the fact it lasted as long as it did, and it did have this, you know, enduring impact. So what do we think that the pool did absolutely right that other organisations should seek to emulate?
It's that they took the time to figure out what their audience wanted. It was one of the things that really impressed me about Sam Baker when we spoke. She said, well, actually, before we launched the site, I took a whole year out to research. Right, these are the women we want to reach. What do they want? How do they consume content? And, you know, how do they want to be spoken to? Which meant that when they launched, they hit that straight away.
The way they didn't just do that fire hose of content was actually what was interesting about it.
Yeah, I was going to say as well, it wasn't just kind of this, you know, the deliberate nature of how they published it. It was what they published as well. I think the people were right. The Pool was publishing stuff that other people weren't even commissioning. In better news, though, Hearst seems to have managed to transform itself from a legacy publisher into a nimble modern media player. So it's posted notable growth across web, mobile and video, according to the latest Magazine Media 360 brand audience report. And it's posted record profits for the 8th consecutive year, which isn't unheard of, but it is relatively rare. So what's actually been going on at Hearst, and why are people sort of saying, you know, this is the new model?
So there's a bunch of stuff going on with this. So the new president, Troy Young, took over from David Carey a while back, and he's been credited with turning the business around. I actually think that's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
I think David Carey did a brilliant job with that publishing group. He was the first person I ever heard saying that a publishing business needed multiple revenue streams. He's talked about half a dozen revenue streams.
What?
And that was way back in 2012. What's that face?
2012?
Yeah.
Surely that should have been the strategy forever.
As reported by The Economist in 2012. I think he set the foundation for Hearst being a good publishing company or a successful publishing company. And then Troy Young's come in and he is Mr. Digital. Mm. I said this earlier. I'm desperately looking for a reason not to like Troy Young because it's like he's come in and everyone says he's brilliant and he's doing great stuff and it's thinking, well, that's too good to be true. And actually, no, he seems to be really doing what needs to be done.
I think you accidentally stumbled across our philosophy at Media Voices. We look for reasons to dislike people until we can't anymore.
Well, I think if you're a print aficionado,
that's exactly it.
So, to what extent then do we think this is to do with Hearst's stable of brands? Because it does have some very premium titles, which isn't something that, you know, its competitors can necessarily replicate.
Yeah, I mean that's part of it. It creates opportunities for them, but they're not. The point is they're not scared to take the opportunities. So I saw something a couple of weeks ago about I'm going to forget the name of the magazine. Is it Town and Country?
Yeah.
Who's gone in, the editors from Town and Country have gone in and helped a hotel chain rebrand. It's almost like they're licensing the Town and Country name into these hotels. That's nuts, but it worked. The hotel's now got more people staying at it, and Town and Country and Hearst is making money from it. And more people are probably buying Town and Country because they stayed at that hotel. That's clever.
That is clever. So from the What's New Publishing article, which was written about this, Hearst has the highest number of brands on the list, talking about the growth rates of 110 magazines in November of last year. And it is Elle Decor, Cosmo, Town and Country, House Beautiful, Harper's Bazaar, Esquire and Road and Track.
Yeah, and I guess in some ways that's at the luxury end of the market, which we know is still doing pretty well in print.
Mm-hmm. It's got a solid foundation.
Yeah.
You know, it's very easy to... I saw somebody saying this about digital startups and digital publishing. It's very easy when you are a publisher that has this great legacy revenue base on which to draw. It's very easy to experiment. But, you know, fair play to Hearst for actually making the correct bets with that. And talking of people that it's very easy to hate, Facebook and ProPublica are in some weird row over ad transparency tools. I know we talk about Facebook a lot, but this one's...
That's because Facebook are constantly... I don't even know what's going on there. It's literally, I like that. There were two or three things this week with Facebook and being in trouble again. And it's just got to say, just like, oh, for goodness sake, I just can't keep up.
What were they doing? They were paying teenagers or whatever to track their stuff on their phone.
Yeah, 20 grand or something.
To be fair, so was Google, and Google have only just been caught out with it.
I mean, I'd accept 20 grand for that.
Yeah, I'd let someone come and live in my house for 20 grand.
Anyway.
Even Facebook.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I'd like
Mark Zuckerberg coming, as long as he didn't kill any goats or anything.
ProPublica posted a piece saying that a number of organisations, including them, had found that the tools they had developed to let the public see exactly how Facebook users were being targeted by advertisers have all stopped working this week. So they were building a searchable database of political ads and the segments of the population advertisers were paying to reach. And the implication is that Facebook, not being able to stop this on a sort of legislative level, decided to go into the tech and disable the features that would have allowed ProPublica to do this.
I hate starting a sentence with this, but in Facebook's defence,
Facebook, you have taken that 20 grand from them.
Chris, I'm not young enough for them to be interested in me. They Facebook have actually kind of come back to this and said that they do updates to make sure that things like third-party web browser plugins can't access information like that, because they say actually as soon as you start letting one person do that with whatever good intentions, you open that door for bad actors to do the same thing. So if you can extract that information through a web browser, they're like, well, actually,
I just did this flash on Nicolas Cage there.
But okay, so Esther, why is this important then? What are people concerned about when they talk about we need to increase transparency around ad targeting?
I mean, it's this idea that you can kind of measure all the stuff you do yourself, and Facebook are like, look, we've got all the tools to do this already. You know, we're launching the political ad tools to do archives and things like that. But there's still a lot of questions about how honest they're actually being about it. And I think from previous things, we can't trust Facebook's own assessment of itself.
You think?
So I think ProPublic has already, as part of this, highlighted a number of ads from places like the NRA that should have been labelled as political and aren't. And the other thing that Facebook doesn't do is that it doesn't... So if you see an advert and you say, OK, why am I seeing this? It says, oh, because Facebook wants to reach people between 18 and 35. It doesn't give you any more information than that. But there's actually a load of, like, micro-targeting going on around race, ethnicity, religion, for a lot of the political ads that just aren't disclosed.
Facebook's woes don't end there, as Snopes, who I've previously cited as being kind of the model for verification of facts and misinformation online, Snopes announced it was pulling out of its verification partnership with Facebook, citing the fact that its time could be better spent creating verification tools for the entire internet, not just for one platform.
No one can verify the entire internet. That is ridiculous.
But then, you know, this comes back to exactly what ProPublica are talking about, that you can do your web browser extensions, but if Facebook block them, you're back to square one.
Mm. Actually, the verification. So I've just seen that the headline in brief list, and this verification thing. NewsGuard's done a U-turn on its classification on the Daily Mail. It now is a reliable source, where before it was unreliable. I don't want to trust anyone to verify my information other than me.
Mm. Well, that's a shame, because you have the time possibly to verify this stuff, but most people don't. They just want to look up and see a green, an amber, or a red light to tell them it's true, unverified, or bollocks.
So how come this company is now saying that the Daily Mail or the Mail Online is not bollocks?
Well, because
what's going on?
Okay, so they met with a Daily Mail executive who wishes to remain unnamed, and as a result of that meeting, at which no money changed hands, I'm positive that absolutely no money was slid across the table in a brown paper envelope, they went from an unreliable source of news to a reliable source of news. But once again, I just want to make very clear, we don't know that any money changed hands. We don't know that. But you know what? It's still not considered a reliable source of information by Wikipedia.
Or by me.
Peter, why don't you launch your own verification tool?
Yeah.
People just see something online, they ring you up.
Yeah.
And then you go,
is this
bollocks.
Right?
Yeah.
Who wrote it? No! Don't trust that fool!
Peter, how long have you been in the media analysis game now?
Oh, maybe a decade.
But interviewing people for like various reasons?
3 decades, longer.
And is it fair to say that transcribing your interviews is one of the worst parts of the job?
Yes, it is the dark night of the soul.
You know what the worst part of it is for me? Is having to hear my big, dumb northern voice constantly interrupting the guests.
Yeah, absolutely. Although that's the nice thing about podcast editing, you can sort of duck the track out and you disappear. But that doesn't help when it comes to transcribing.
No, it doesn't. So luckily we have a partnership with Trint, who have a clever automated transcription tool which makes our life much, much easier. So there are links to try Trint within our newsletter, and honestly I recommend anything that lets you sort of sidestep the tricky issue of having to listen to your own voice ad nauseum forever.
Give it a go. This week I spoke with Brian Morrissey, Editor-in-Chief at Media and Marketing Publishers DigiDay. We spoke about publishing economics and sustainability, how B2B is cool, how he doesn't like to be called a trade publisher, and the value of being really honest about business change. But first I asked him, how long has he been covering the media business?
Well, Peter, I've been covering this probably since, I guess, going back to 2000, really, so a long time, in different forms for different publications. But about 8 years ago, I left Adweek, where I was digital editor, and came to Digiday, which was about 2 years old at the time, but was mostly in events. And the idea in linking up with Nick Fries, who is the founder of Digiday, was, you know, how do you build like a modern media business? And at the time, it was using events as a foundation on which to build, and a foundation of both, you know, a revenue foundation, because events are a good source of immediate revenue. You can spin up revenue pretty quickly if you do them well. But then also the community element. And what I saw with Digiday was that, you know, you could actually expand a community using the event. You know, everyone says events don't scale. That may be true, but like, it really depends on your definition of scale. And critically, I think events were really provided the oxygen to figure things out as far as what the brand was about, because, you know, revenue is the oxygen for any business. Well, cash flow, I should say, cash flow is the revenue of any business.
I think, you know, the events thing, well, that was a model that the Media Briefing kind of followed initially, and, you know, with great success to a point. But how's the business, you know, that covering media changed over, well, from Digiday, I guess, is almost 10 years that Digiday's been going, but for you, almost 20 years. How's the business of covering media changed in that time?
I mean, it's obviously changed like quite a bit. I mean, I can remember, you know, earlier on in my career covering this, it was a lot of just, you know, there was a legitimacy factor of, you know, just digital media. You know, at the time it was just internet media, and particularly coming out of the .com era, a lot of people, you know, were dismissive of the changes that the internet was having on media and marketing. You got to remember, this was really before Google took off. And so once the .com crash happened and all the sort of nonsense pets.com businesses went away, I think a lot of people were dismissive of the entire sector. This is at a time when people were really just getting broadband connections, right? And so I think one of the smartest things that was said to me about that time was that, you know, everyone was looking at the wrong number. They were looking at the NASDAQ number, but they weren't looking at the broadband penetration number. So I think at the time it was a fight for like legitimacy. And, you know, it was exciting. I was at like a publication called DM News to cover the direct marketing industry. And that's where I remember, actually at a previous job, having a meeting with GoTo.com about this crazy idea that they had around paid search. You know, GoTo, which actually became Overture, they were really the people that pioneered the model of paid search. It wasn't Google. Google perfected the model. But covering that, and people really didn't understand how big of a business Google had. I covered Google for years before its IPO. And it was only at the IPO that people realized how gigantic Google was. And that was because Google was aggregating a lot of, you know, smaller at the time. Like, people were, I guess, they were amazed when Google said that it had 200,000 advertisers, right? You know, you know, Facebook now is what they said yesterday, they have 7 million. But I think that, you know, seeing these models grow, and then, you know, now we're at a period where there's not like a question about the legitimacy. There's a question about like whether there's too much power of, you know, these technology companies. So, you know, I think in covering it and living it, it has always been, you know, for me, like the biggest focus, maybe that's a self-preservation sort of thing, was, you know, how do you build sustainable media businesses in this area that's completely changing, as, you know, delivery goes over to digital models, but also the economics go into digital models.
The economics, though, is the bit that we're all struggling with right now, yeah?
Yeah. Obviously. I mean, this is a big, well, the last couple of weeks here in the U.S. with well, also abroad, but like, you know, with BuzzFeed's layoffs, with Gannett having cutbacks, we just actually pushed a story about Vice having layoffs.
Is it 10% of their workforce?
Something like that, yeah. So, you know, these are massive dislocations that are happening to the media business. And there's an unbelievable amount there's a lot of different causes of them. You know, there's a lot of just, you know, bad businesses are still bad businesses. And I think a lot of these companies are getting their cost bases under control. I think that's what makes this such a compelling story to tell, but also to live, you know, as an independent media company that's trying to grow and thrive and be.
Well, and the best thing in the world for a business to business company like Digiday is for there to be loads of change in the business. Well, because that's when people will, they'll come to events or they'll read your stuff or they'll, you know, they'll buy reports or whatever it is, because they're trying to get that edge.
I mean, I think so. And I think that changes the role of a quote unquote trade publication. And that was sort of one of the original insights we had was that, you know, I really sort of push back against the term trade publication, because to me, it was always code for meaning like, you know, boring and being cheerleader.
Kind of pejorative.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a backwater for, you know, not real journalism. You know, it's a lot of fluffery and stuff like this. And I think that's actually true in a period, in a static period, but I don't think it's true in a dynamic period of change. And I think what our idea was here, and I think you're seeing it in a lot of other areas, I can't say that completely original in it, but maybe we were a little earlier than a lot of people to it, was that in a period of like intense change, you cannot have a trade model that is like that. You know, people, one, you know, the idea that like people separate the kinds of stuff they read because that's their professional interest versus the kinds of things they read because that's their personal interest. That's gone. You have to compete with everyone for their time and attention and focus. And the other is, you know, I think that instead of being cheerleaders, the biggest role you can play is being honest about all of the changes that are going on and the winners and the losers. And so I think it makes trade journalism completely different. It makes it akin to just normal journalism. I don't really like the term trade journalism. It's usually used by people who are in the generalist field. Mm. But I do think that the role changed. But I think that the business models in some ways, you know, B2B publications are really, B2B media companies are really fortunate, because the business models are, you know, they're hard to execute, but they're fairly straightforward.
Everyone wants to be a B2B publisher these days. Condé Nast and Hearst and whatever.
Well, I mean, I think that's because of the business models are seemingly a lot more straightforward when you're not in, you know, look, there's a lot of people who pontificate about the future of media and stuff like this. And the reality is a B2B business model is different from a B2C business model. So, you know, you can be the smartest guy in the room about a B2B business model, but the fact of the matter is very few people on B2B are reinventing. That's not bad. You still have to execute, and execution is everything. But the truth of the matter is the dislocation that's happening to companies like BuzzFeed and Vice is completely and utterly different than the sort of challenges that, you know, a company like Digiday Media, you know, faces. It's just completely different.
On the execution side of it, though, I mean, that's where, so you guys is the same as a bunch of other people, like The Drum or even individuals like Ben Thompson. You're trying to take revenue from that expertise, from that real deep analysis that you provide. How does that, from a revenue mix point of view for a company like Digiday, where you used to be so reliant on events, say, how does that mix look these days?
Well, I would just say this about the, you know, I think the business model is very straightforward. I think, you know, what we look at is we want to put ourselves at the center of industries that are going through a bunch of different change, usually driven by technology, but also by by culture too. So, you know, we started with really publishing, and then we expanded to into marketing and advertising within Digiday. And then we started another publication, Glossy, that was focused on fashion. And then we expanded that into beauty. And so I think we're looking at industries like this, and, you know, the model will change a little bit. But at the heart of the model is, if you put yourself at the center and you make yourself a resource to the people who are grappling with those changes, both from incumbent companies, but also from challenger companies, you have an opportunity to have a diverse amount of ways to make money. So events is like our sort of core, quote unquote, legacy business. It's still the majority of our revenue, but like, you know, the fast, but you know, that's not our only source. We have a content studio that serves all of our brands, that creates original content for our sponsors, and obviously run ads. And we have awards programs, and we do licensing with we have a Japanese site. And you know, and obviously getting people to pay us directly is a big focus now. The key is, like, are you at the center of, and do you mean something to a valuable group of people, you know? And like, that is really, so when we see all these moves on the consumer side, I just think it's a lot harder. It's just a lot harder because the nature of being a consumer publication, that's why I sort of push back on, you know, media profits, you know, that are the PROPHETS that are coming from the B2B side, because the B2C side is dealing with a completely different set of challenges, because, you know, by nature, the areas that they're focused on tend to get more generalist, and they tend to get pulled that way because the models of monetization when it comes to B2C media are usually advertiser driven, and you need a certain amount of scale to do that. It's easy to say you're not about scale when you're constricted by scale. Yes, we're not about scale, but like, of course we're not. We're focused on these industries. I mean, how many people, I mean, I want everyone to read Digiday, but like, come on, I'm like, I'm realistic. Like, it's not going to be 100 million people. So yes, we're not about scale, but like, why would we be?
So when you see people like, Condé Nast just saying they're going to put everything behind a paywall.
Yeah, I think that's really challenging. That's really challenging. Like, I went on Glamour the other day and I found a story about how Meghan Markle is now not closed the car door herself. The issue there is, this is on Glamour. This could be on our neighbors here, Business Insider, now Insider. You know, they have their chart beat that shows outside of the ladies' room, and I swing by it every now and again. And there's like, not the ladies' room, the chart beat. And, you know, there's usually the same Meghan Markle story on there. The challenge there is, like, everyone has the Meghan Markle story. Like, that is, it's commodity celebrity fluff. It's really difficult to, and there's a reason that Glamour is doing that, because like, you're trying to feed the beast of a advertising model. Suddenly charging for that, that's really, really difficult. Yeah. They're just different models. So I think where you're seeing, I think you'll see subscriptions work in a few instances, but they're going to fail in more instances than not. Because, you know, look, someone like Condé Nast, they'll bring in like McKinsey and stuff like this, and they'll put in place these subscription programs. But in order to get enough people to convert, you're going to have to lower the price point to such a degree that the numbers simply do not work with the cost base that a lot of these publications have. That's what we'll end up seeing continue. I would love to say that the recent, you know, rounds of layoffs and stuff are the last ones that, you know, we'll report on, but I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that there's a lot of publications that are going to end up having to really get their cost base under control. And the reality is, in a media company, your biggest cost is your payroll.
The notion of scale that you've just described in B2B, do you think some of these consumer testers just need to get a clue and start working on a different kind of scale? Both their cost base and their audience.
Some of my favorite, you know, models are in B2C, but are a little bit more, you know, focused. And because there are, you know, so one example, you know, they're in Europe, but also in New York too, is like High Snobiety. So this is a bootstrap publication, started in David Fisher's dorm room in Zurich, and he was just really into sneakers and stuff. And this is right when the streetwear boom was really starting, and he started a blog. And then and then moved to Berlin, because I think Berlin is where like young people go to retire, right? And so there's a good workforce there to write about streetwear. And they grew this publication and this media brand that really means something to a group of people, particularly young men who are into sneakers and fashion. When I was growing up, a lot of people were not into this stuff. I look around at a lot of the young people here, and they really are, and it expands into music and other parts of culture. They have a brand that means something to a valuable audience, and they have a bunch of different ways that they can monetize. So I think there are models out there of people that are making it work that are, you know, kind of taking B2B type approaches in that they are focused on specific areas. And they're putting themselves at the center of those specific areas, and then they're building diverse revenue models around that.
Does a business like Condé Nast then just become a bunch of really, really niche titles?
They should have. I mean, you can argue that they should have, but I mean, it's the innovator's dilemma, right? Like, if you have Vanity Fair and you are doing the Vanity Fair Oscars party with, you know, all these celebrities, like, man, like, that's pretty attractive. But, you know, I think you gotta bet on something. I was actually just in London and did a podcast with Wolfgang Blau at Condé Nast International. And I think, you know, it's very interesting because the US Condé Nast has lost tons of money and stuff, and the international has always been done better, at least over the last several years. And I think the opportunity there in like really doubling down on Vogue and really finding ways for, you could argue that they're late, but like brand like Vogue, in all the different markets it operates, there's so many different ways that that brand can make money. I think a lot of, forget about the focus thing, I think the second part, a lot of B2C publications sort of missed was these diverse revenue models, because look, everyone like criticizes advertising now, but the truth about advertising is it is a high margin and can be a very lucrative business. Advertising is a good business, you know? Like, everyone talks about like, oh, sponsored content and stuff like that. Man, that is low margin. You will end up spending all your margin on production. Advertising is fantastic. It's great. High margin.
Everyone should be back selling space.
I'm not saying that you should go back to those days, but there's a reason that people did not diversify their business.
Yeah, and I guess we forget that. We kind of go, oh, advertising, why didn't people move on years ago? But actually, you're absolutely right. Why would you move on when you're making a bunch of money?
There's no reason. You know, and it's like, at least everyone here like sort of mourns, you know, newspapers. How did newspapers allow this to happen to themselves? And stuff like this? Well, I'll tell you how, because they were cash cows. I mean, I forget who said it, was like an old saying, it was like a license to print money. And, you know, there was a lot of changes going on around newspapers that they ignored because they were printing money.
So you started out with these two channels you were looking at, media marketing and publishing. are those coming closer together, or are they still quite separate?
No, they're not separate. I mean, that's why it's under like one brand. I mean, it's a, you know, you can't really cover the media side without covering the marketer side, because, you know, most of, you know, leaving aside the pivot to paid and stuff, you know, up until now, most of media has been driven by the advertisers, right? The advertising has been, you know, they've been supplying the oxygen to the room. And so I think you can't cover one without the other. You read articles about like, you know, BuzzFeed and stuff like this, and it never touches. It never touches on things like programmatic advertising. I mean, it might not be a sexy topic, but, you know, you can't write, I don't think you can really write a story about the challenges BuzzFeed is going through without talking about programmatic advertising and whether or not it was too late to actually adopt programmatic advertising.
I mean, do you think that's a problem in media in general, that people don't talk about money?
I think it's getting a lot better. I think, you know, I think some of it is the sort of the quote unquote wall that has existed in journalism. I think for many years it was almost a point of pride for journalists to not really understand how businesses worked. And it was painted as, you know, this ethical sort of thing. But, you know, look, the truth is, like, every single newsroom, the more you rose up, the more that you had to deal with the sales concerns. So I think that was like more like on a junior level. But I think now, just because of all of the changes going on, reporters are a lot more aware of the business realities of how the companies they work for make money. I know, like, when I'm doing, you know, interviews now, particularly with, you know, more inexperienced or younger people, you know, they really want to know about the business model and how it works and stuff. Because, you know, that's just learned through, I mean, how many rounds of layoffs can you go through before you start asking questions?
Yeah, definitely. So who should we be watching? What media companies out there should we be paying attention to? Who's doing it right?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I mentioned some, look, I like a lot of people, and maybe this is my bias. I mean, I find more interesting the people that have, you know, narrowed in on specific audiences and are building really diversified businesses around them. I think we're going to continue to have the stories about the large venture funded media companies that are going through challenges and are cutting their cost base, and that unfortunately involves laying off people. But I think that there's that can obscure a lot of success cases when it comes to media, you know, both small, and I think it's easier to, like, it's easier to point to models that are a lot smaller that are able to build sustainable media businesses. Like, I'm very proud that, like, you know, we have a very sustainable model that's profitable, and we're now like 80 people, but it's small compared to a lot of these bigger things. And you operate different businesses than, you know, a Gannett or something like this. It's hard to, but I think there are a lot of, you know, I would point to like someone like Complex Networks. You know, I think they made a really good decision to, you know, at the time of everyone pivoting to video, which was really a pivot to Facebook, they really focused on building franchises. Yes, they quote unquote pivoted to video, but they did it in the right way. And I think, you know, building up franchises and IP that they can sell and make money off in a variety of different ways, you know, including selling hot sauce and things, that is like a success case of the pivot to video that I think sometimes is obscured. And I'll say that we do some of this ourselves with some of the people that pivoted to Facebook, and we call it the pivot to video. So I think there are a lot of different models out there, and I hope that we can, you know, on my own podcast and the Digiday podcast, I mean, I'm hoping to highlight a lot more of those, and without it being just about small publishers that are able to build profitable businesses. Because again, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's just completely different. It's a completely different proposition, you know, building those kind of more niche businesses than it is to, you know, trying to operate a giant media company, giant B2C media company.
The last question we always ask our guests is, what was the last piece of media you read or watched or listened to that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
You know, I have been listening to this podcast. It's around a podcast. I'm going to talk about podcasts. It's called The Dropout. I think it's done by ABC News and Nightline. And it is about the Theranos story. I cannot get enough of the Theranos story. The Bad Blood, the book, was amazing. I don't know if you read it. It makes for a very compelling serialized podcast because you know, you start to realize that with a lot of like PR and marketing and a lot of, you know, big names backing, people didn't ask a lot of the basic questions about this because they were wrapped up in the narrative and the vision. And to me, it's a reminder, as we do our work here, whether it's in the media marketing industry or whether it's in, you know, fashion and beauty, or now we're doing a lot more in retail, is don't get wrapped up in the vision and the hype and the marketing, and start to ask the basic question.
Thank you very much for listening this week. But until next week, when we're going to be back with another incredible guest, thank you very much for listening. Tell all your friends about Media Voices, and goodbye.
Bye. Or follow us on Twitter too. Media Voices Pod.
Good save.